Moving to 10. Mr. Hoffman.
Good morning still.
Good morning.
Hey. How can you send us these big things that we have to read?
We need to go to a gym with one of these.
Books are getting bigger.
No, we only get so much for a meeting, and this is way beyond.
You'll be noted.
Okay.
Future presentations will be a little bit more succinct. So we have several items to cover, too. So items 10 and 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15. And so the book contains all of those. We'll separate those out in the future.
Duly noted.
So before we jump into a review of the performance of the plan, let's take a quick look at tab one, and I'll keep this brief in terms of our outlook on the economy and what we're seeing, because it's a lot more of the same in many respects. We're seeing a GDP that kind of bounces along in a 2% range. Maybe we're seeing a recent uptick in that, which is nice. But on the right-hand side of this, page five, you'll see that this is basically what the Fed is looking at. 2% GDP, next to no real signs of inflation. Unemployment continues to drop down. The 10-year rate on our U.S. Treasury is right around 1.8, and that hasn't changed much. I think it's closing in on 1.9 today, so it's basically in that same range. And so, okay, that's what the Fed is looking at, and oddly enough, this isn't much different than what it was looking at a quarter ago. So at December 31st, very similar numbers.
Out of curiosity, the CPI number you use, is that a national number or is that the Nine Bay Area County?
That's the national number.
You know there's a considerable difference between the two at times.
There is. Right. So we're trying to capture more of what our Fed is looking at from national policymaking kind of perspective with this page.
All right. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah, and so what they're seeing, GDP, which really hasn't changed much, is interesting because in December, when they did raise rates, they were talking about 4 rate hikes this year, and that tenor has really changed, so now it's more like 2, maybe even 1. And so over the past week or so, that has changed for the June outlook. The expectation was about a 10% chance that the Fed would raise rates in June,
wow.
And that's changed to about 30%. So some good numbers have come out.
And a while ago, I was hearing it was almost definite they were going to raise, and now...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then that came off pretty dramatically. Now it kind of looks like it's back on the table. And interestingly, some of the fund managers are saying, yeah, it looks good for a raise. I mean, who asks them, but, you know, some journalists are. But they're kind of giving the green light. Our economists looked at it one time, and so, I think I shared this with you in the past, was if you take the Fed's rate decisions and overlay those with the equity market price levels, you'll see that the equity markets tell the Fed when to raise. And so it's kind of a cynical view, but there's something to it. I mean, the numbers kind of support the viewpoint that when the equity market's correct, the Fed tends to back away and won't do it. I think what's interesting this time around is going to be Brexit. And so as the language, the rhetoric starts building more and more about what's going on with Brexit and what that could do to companies and the displacement that could have, one way or the other, really, it creates uncertainty in the market. And we know that the Fed doesn't ignore that. They can't directly incorporate it into their decisions, but they recognize that the market uncertainty is something else they have to contend with. And so with Brexit vote happening on June 23rd and our Fed taking action about a week before that, it will be interesting to see whether that causes them to pause here. And it may very well. We'll see. So Brexit is an interesting discussion. And so that's kind of this odd dynamic between immigration policies across Europe and the UK and GDP and relative importance. And how important is the UK to Europe and how important is Europe to the UK and those ties between the two. They're pretty strong.
Do you have a prediction on the vote?
So I was just going to go there. The polls currently suggest it's kind of split. And the polls in the past have been really off on things like this. So you got to take those with a grain of salt. We think it's pretty unlikely. We think that the consequences are too high and that as more and more come out leading up to the final vote, people are going to step away from it. So a part of it is related to the uncertainty of it all. What if they did leave? And what if they leave? That analysis tends to suggest a recession, and they probably don't want to go through a recession. Not self-induced, anyhow. There's also a political aspect to it in that labor-friendly politicians encourage immigration, and so the immigration that's coming from Europe to UK is favored by them. Wouldn't they want to keep that going? That's part of who votes them into power. There's something to be said for that. And the economic ties are pretty strong. The UK relies much more heavily on Europe, the Eurozone, than the Eurozone relies on the UK. So for them to separate is really going to be a hard pill to swallow. So I think when we take that all into consideration, it seems less likely than more so. A couple other things around the world. Japan continues its economic stimulus. And we've watched this over the years because their version of quantitative easing is like a 2x what we did here with our quantitative easing. They're fighting a demographic headwind, and that's pretty challenging. And so for them to get any signs of inflation, any signs of economic growth are really hard to do when you just have so many people retiring, so many people consuming less and buying less. So Abenomics and the other policymakers there continue with this, and they're looking at how they can stimulate it more. At the same time, they promised to have a tax increase, a sales tax increase, and they did this a couple years ago, and it was interesting. They brought sales tax from 5% to 8%, and when they did that, essentially the day before, the month before, it happened, I think, at the beginning of March, if I remember correctly, that February was a huge purchasing of consumer goods. They yes. just went out and bought everything. And now they're looking at taking that 8% sales tax to 10%. And they know what's going to happen if they do it. And so they keep trying to delay it. They have a debt to pay, and so they need the tax revenues in some form or another. So they feel like it's coming, but they're not ready for it yet. And so with the demographic headwinds, it's hard to see when that's going to happen. One other thing I wanted to update you on is we talked last time about energy companies and some of the bankruptcies. And last time, so a quarter ago, it was Sandridge and Energy Partners 21 had been speculated as being late on bond payments. This is probably going to lead to bankruptcy filing, and that could have some more turmoil. That's what the energy markets are going through because oil was so low. Oil has since rebounded, so it's come from 26 to now almost $50 a barrel. That's not enough. And so since the beginning of 2015, 130 companies have announced bankruptcy in the energy space. And that amounts to $60 billion worth of high-yield debt that is being defaulted on. That's pretty interesting because you can find those numbers in the press. I mean, this is data reported by Reuters and Bloomberg and the Journal and what have you. But you're not hearing it talked about as a contagion kind of level. And when you take a look at price, the oil price behavior of today and recently and compare it back, you have to go back to the 80s when that happened. And the 80s had that kind of price correction that really caused bankruptcies in banks in throughout Texas. And you look at it today and say, well, why is it different? A lot of it has to do with the regulations and Basel II, Basel III, and similar Dodd-Frank and what have you, forcing the banks out of this type of business. They aren't lending to those companies, not as much. The financials have been hurt this quarter because of ties to energy, but the energy exposure that they have today is more of revolving credit. So shorter term, much shorter term, higher quality loans to energy companies that can expire quickly and they can get out of. So JP Morgan Chase had a loss and that hit earnings per share, and that's real. But it's nothing like the contagion that we've seen before because the banks did indeed get out of this kind of business. And this is what we hear about on the other side with the investment managers coming to us and saying, we have bank loans. We invest in bank loan and high yield debt. They're fulfilling that gap that the banks left behind. So pretty interesting to see that play out.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned this because the way it reads in the journal, it's reported, as you say, but it's not given any particular alarm level. It doesn't seem to be. It's almost as if it's business as usual. Yeah. You know, a little trouble in the oil patch, and so it doesn't have the, I think you used the word contagion.
Yeah.
It's a good word for it.
Yeah. It's keeping the contagion at bay. Last thing I wanted to talk about were the quarterly earnings. So we're pretty much done now with S&P 500 companies reporting their earnings results. I think this is interesting because the numbers are down. Year over year, earnings declined by about 7%. The expectation going into the quarter was that they'd decline closer to 9%. So, yay, we only declined 7%. That's a victory. So that's when we take a look at, so that's the fourth consecutive quarter that we've had declines. So that's odd. We haven't had that since late 08, early 2009. So we're going through a bit of an earnings recession here. 2Q earnings are projected to drop again, another percent or two, so not as bad. Third quarter looking positive, fourth quarter looking more positive. So what's that mean to the equity markets? We're currently at close to 2,100 on the S&P 500. That's a price to earnings multiple of over 16 and a half, probably closing in on 17 now. So we're paying what is historically a high valuation for earnings that have declined, look like they're bottoming, and will recover in the second half of the year. That strikes us as a little bit odd. That doesn't feel like a value play. Why would you pay a higher multiple for earnings that are troughing and hopefully recovering, but with some uncertainty? So that's where we are today in the equity markets. So in thinking about how that then ties into our valuation work and how we talk about constructing FFP, we're lighter on domestic equities for that reason. We don't see the earnings potential there, and we don't understand why you'd pay up for it. If you had the earnings multiple come back from 16.5 to 14.5, that's about a 13% correction. And if you have a 13% correction in the U.S. equity markets, we'd all be pretty upset. We'd be pretty shocked by that. That's not something we want to endure. But when you look at the numbers in this way, it looks like, yeah, that's totally reasonable. I can see why the market would do that. 14.5 seems like a long-term average that could be sustained.
Ed Zachers Paulson, our first economic speaker, I had a view that I captured in my quick notes, that he expected things to continue basically as they are, moving upward slowly. Did not see a correction. And I suppose the argument could be that, no, the bull market will continue. And the argument could be that the market is always looking forward. It's not that today valuation of 16-something is probably within a historic range of where you'd see it. And what the market is looking at is what it's going to be third and fourth quarter, and anticipating that.
Right.
I just offer.
So, and I think that ties in nicely. So taking his comments then and saying, okay, if the equity market is looking forward, what do the analysts currently see going forward? And so they see lower earnings in 2Q, slightly higher in 3Q, higher in 4Q. So how accurate will those be? Well, the earnings is a bit of a game. And when we see these numbers come out for the S&P 500 in aggregate, what we find out is typically about 70% of the company beat on the earnings estimate. So they sandbag. They tell the analysts, yeah, we're only going to make whatever cents per share, and they know they're going to beat that by a penny or two. So they sandbag it a little bit. So, okay, let's say that the analyst projections are a little bit low, and they come and the actuals come in a little bit higher. It still makes us question why you would want to pay up for it. It's still within a reasonable range. You could still have a 16.5 multiple or even go to a 17 multiple and not have an issue. It doesn't mean that there's a sell on this, but it does inform our perspective on a 10-year outlook and saying, how much do we expect to earn in the U.S. equity markets over the next 10 years? And at today's valuations, we don't see that there is a tremendous amount of upside, because we think you're going to get, you know, your dividend income. You're going to get some price appreciation just as the companies organically grow and what have you. But aside from that, it doesn't seem like that price to earnings multiple has much give to raise.
Just one quick thought on that, that you've got Exxon, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and several more, Schlumberger, all just terrible earnings vis-a-vis their norm, and they give or take are in the top 10
right
in the S&P 500, and it's value weighted. So if you were to carve those out, what's the rest of it look like? Is it much more normal?
Well, I guess the question would be, if oil continues to recover, wouldn't those companies then recover?
You'd expect them to recover, but if you're measuring right now, they could easily have a disproportionate impact, I would think, on that average S&P 500 numerator.
Yeah, and it's the combination of the oil price is going to impact the energy companies directly, but oil is an input cost to pretty much the rest of us. and to all the other companies. So a rising oil price is going to help that energy sector for sure. Stabilizing oil prices have already helped it. So those companies could indeed stay where they are or rebound further. The rest of the companies will actually have a higher input cost because of higher oil. And so then it's, you'll probably have a...
Some offset.
Or you could do what Southwest does and just keep raising airfares notwithstanding.
That's exactly
No bargain, then.
Buy LUV. Hedge your bet.
All right. Let me ask you to turn to page 18. This is a large, colorful slide that is pretty interesting because you're hearing a lot about this around the world, too, negative interest rates. So tab 1, page 18. And this chart shows that each of these five countries is now in negative rate territory, Eurozone, Japan, Sweden, Denmark, and Switzerland. And it's kind of an odd environment. It creates some odd incentives, and it is definitely uncharted territory. In fact, if you go back here, the first country to have done it is Denmark, that we're showing in roughly 2012, mid-2012. So they've been in this environment for about 4 years now, and what are we seeing? There's an interesting article on the family in the Netherlands that is getting paid on their mortgage. So literally, the homeowner gets his mortgage payment coupon, and he made money on it, and he still has to pay off principal, but the interest is back to him. So 4 years of this, and this is what happens. And so it looks like an untenable situation. The bank has to endure negative interest rates, so they would like to charge depositors. Anyone saving money at their bank, they'd like to charge them. That's pretty hard to do, so they can't really do that. Otherwise, they'll just leave. So they can't charge them. And they're paying out on mortgage and other things, so the governments are really squeezing them. And that's the part that doesn't look like this is a tenable situation, because they are supposed to be earning profits. So they have to earn money somewhere else in their business, lending elsewhere, or doing whatever else they can, or rewriting these mortgages. So it's an odd set of incentives, and frankly, it's an unknown. We get a lot of white papers and research topics about this is what's going to happen with negative rates. Here's where we're going with this thing. This is why the U.S. won't do it. Well, who knows? I mean, this is not something academics have really spent a lot of time in. And 5 years ago, if you had asked me, I'd say, no, it doesn't make any sense at all. And sure enough, here we are. One thing we do know, though, is that it creates a strong demand for U.S. treasuries. And so this interesting argument of, like, rates will rise, our 10-year is so cheap, why would anybody buy that? Or 30-year only, you know, earning 2 and change, why would anyone buy that? This is why. Because you got to invest somewhere, and if you can't take risky positions and you have to be safe, you're going to invest in things that are. So this is creating a demand for U.S. Treasuries.
In the mortgage scenario, is that like an adjustable rate that's tied to an index?
I assume so. Okay. Yeah, I don't have the details on it, but it must have been for it to do that. I can't imagine underwriting that otherwise, but yeah. On page 19, then, takes that yield discussion a little bit further. In the upper left-hand corner is the U.S. yield curve over time. So the orange line is showing it back in 2005, and you can see how much we have come down. The yellow line is where we are today, or March 31st. And then comparing that on the right-hand side to the other developed markets, we have China at the top, and then pretty much all the other countries are below us, and some of them pretty significantly so. So negative interest rates out to 7, 8, 9 years. So again, we're not sure rates have to rise. Let's jump ahead then to page 42. This is the periodic table. Always a fun place to look at. Table that keeps us all humble if you think you know what's going to happen. On the right-hand side, we have the 5- and 10-year numbers. And so let me just work through some of these because I think there are some interesting observations. The bottom is commodities, negative 6.2% over the past 10 years. Then cash at 1%. Hedge funds of funds at 1.5%. And then the next two are international equity and emerging market equities, so 1.8 and 3.0. So they have had a difficult time. And you can see year to date, which is the column a couple to the left there, that emerging market equity is actually recovering pretty nicely year to date, 5.7%. But these are two of the main reasons why we think that there is a valuation opportunity more so internationally than what we're seeing here domestically. The top categories are almost all U.S. equities. The top one is large cap growth at 8.3, followed by real estate at 7.8. So really nice, strong numbers from real estate. And also we've seen within our own portfolio here that that has had pretty low volatility to it. And then large cap core and the rest. We flip ahead to page 44. S&P 500 broken out by sector for the quarter and year to date. So the sector returns for the quarter are also interesting. Telecom, top performer. Utilities at second. So utilities has had this pattern of being one of the top or bottom performers over the past several quarters. Typically, you invest in utilities because of the stability of the dividend. Here, it's a flight to safety during a quarter that was highly volatile. And if you take that and take a look at the bottom two, healthcare and financials, -5.1 and -5.5. Wow. So those two sectors go through a correction during the quarter. Most active managers are going to be underweight utilities, overweight financials and healthcare. Most active managers underperformed this quarter. We see that in our own portfolio some. We had some that outperformed nicely. But that is an interesting quarter for active management. The worst quarter in 20 years for active managers in domestic equities. And so this is kind of the why behind that. It's an odd quarter when you have this happen. And then page 45 has the index returns. And just quickly, we can see that domestic equity in the upper left-hand side had a nice month. The month of March was a big recovery to bring the quarter to date flat to slightly positive. Down below, international equities, a similar story, strong recovery in the month of March. The numbers for the quarter, slightly negative. Japan there, we see that as -6.5% for the quarter. Emerging market Latin America, positive 20%. A lot of that has to do with Brazil since the announcement of the process of impeaching their president. The market recovered about 40%.
Significant. That's an idea. For the U.S. markets.
On the upper right-hand side, fixed income, roughly flat and slightly positive, which is nice to see, and then other commodities, REITs, and emerging market debt indices. So, we'll pause there on the market review. And are there any questions? And if not, we'll jump into the plan.
Picking up on Jerry's comment, at some time during your presentation, you shared with all of us how to pick a drummer at Sackers. I would ask you to share that with the board as a whole when that moment is appropriate.
That there are three types of drummers?
There are three types, right.
Those that can count and those that can't.
Right.
You ever played in a band? If you're a drummer. Yeah. It's a fun... It's fun to play drums. There's not much respect for it. It's the Rodney Dangerfield instrument. Turning to tab two, we have the portfolio reconciliation. So starting the quarter out at about $7.1 billion, net withdrawals of about $81 million, mostly offset by investment earnings, which is nice to see. So ending market value again at about $7.1 billion. Pages 3 and 4 are asset allocation over time and current. The only thing to note here is on page 4 in the upper right-hand table, we have the no by cash, so slightly larger, 1.1% versus 1.0%. So nothing too alarming, probably unsettled trades or something of that nature. Page 5, taking a look at the performance, actually pretty strong performance relative to peers in a very choppy market. So we see on a gross of fees basis, ranking in the 43rd percentile for the quarter, and our one-year number right below top quartile at 28%. And just taking a look at the major asset categories, you see that the performance really comes from the fixed income side. Domestic fixed income, positive 2.8, and global fixed income, positive 5.7. Those were the places to be, and so more conservatively invested funds would have done better in that respect. High yield, also a positive 2.1%, which is pretty interesting to see because of all the bankruptcies and the energy troubles. So a lot of that was fleshed out earlier in the quarter and in 2015, late 2015. Then taking a look at the individual managers, page 9, I wanted to touch on page 9 first. I think this is a pretty important page because it's the only real page that compares total fund risk and return. And we talked with you last quarter about the FFP 4-year, and we ended up on Mix B. And Mix B had a targeted return of 7.5% with an annualized standard deviation of about 9.8. So keeping those numbers in mind, here we're seeing over the past 5 years actual returns of 8%, even better, with lower standard deviation, 7.6. So the plan has done really well on both those dynamics.
Come out of it really fast.
On page 10, getting into the individual managers, I want to jump down to Jackson Square Partners.
Yeah.
They had a difficult quarter for sure, 97th percentile, which really is brought down their longer term numbers as well. So they had some nice outperformance. So that single quarter of negative 6.1 against an index that posted a positive 0.7 really hurt them. So tying back to the comments on healthcare, we saw healthcare as a sector was down about 5.5% in the quarter. They got hit with that for sure because they had Celgene and Allergan, but also they had Valeant. And so Valeant was a real disappointment this quarter. That stock alone was down 74%. Mm-hmm. At the end of the quarter, they still had a 1.3% position in it, and they have subsequently exited that entirely. So I think the story on Jackson Square's story on Valeant was that we see it as M&A being important to this space, that there's a need for a company to come in and acquire and cut out a lot of the overhead that we see in this industry, and Valeant is doing it, and that looks attractive. What happened, though, with Valeant's problems is that story doesn't come to fruition, and as it doesn't come to fruition, Jackson Square continues to stay in it, believing in the story and actually buying more as the stock comes down. Okay, we see that in other times. As it continues to come down and you see it unraveling, it's like, okay, well, the thesis on the stock has changed. Now it looks like a value story. So this gives us some pause, because when a thesis changes on a stock, that makes us ask, so what is your process then? Why do you allow yourself to go through, we invested in it as a growth stock, it's not growing. Okay, does that mean you exit? Lots of times it will. In this case, they reassessed it, said, oh, we like it as a value opportunity. We'll continue to keep our position in it and buy more. So that gives us some pause, and we'll have to keep them under consideration. That's not what we want to see.
That's a change from what their agreement has been with us. Their agreement has been their large growth.
That's right. You have them hired their large cap growth manager.
Switching it out. I understand the philosophy. I mean, it's going down lower and lower. Let's buy it because it's going to start to go up. But that's pretty, 97 percentile is pretty low. The other one I was worried about, and maybe you're going to go there, is William Blair. Mm-hmm. 71 percentile, 80 percentile for the 1 year. That's a little bit low. I mean, it's close to like what's going on, but not what's going on. Mm-hmm. Anything there?
So nothing that gives us any pause. They're underweight emerging markets, and emerging markets did well this quarter. So okay, fine. Overweight UK. UK in the Brexit discussion, that didn't play out well. So that's increasing the issues there. So those two things. And then underweight Canada was just another side highlight on it all. So I think that their process and philosophy are still the same. And when we take a look then over the past 5 years, it doesn't look like this is too much of a blip. They had underperformance in 2011 and 2015. Mm-hmm. Now it's continuing into 2016. So past times where they've had underperformance, they've recovered nicely in 2012.
Five-year numbers has plausible. It's mm-hmm. just the last year, and so that's okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Scott, did you have a question?
Jackson Square Partners suggests, in your mind, a lack of discipline in terms of the investment decision and management?
It's spin control. Did we tell you that we're a value fund today? We were a rough fund yesterday.
Spin control.
It does. I mean, that's the question we ask them. When Valiant was going down, was there some sort of risk control process that was tipped to make you say, oh, this has gone down too much, we should get out? And no, their answer was no. We didn't have that.
That's kind of revisionist history. I mean, it's acquired as a growth stock, and it's clearly not growing. So, I mean, I'm thinking of all the times we've had investment managers come through here, and, you know, the focus is on the value of the committee discussion, the rigor with which they analyze the investment and so on, the amount of time it takes, the due diligence, all of that stuff. And it sounds like in this case, you just toss that out the window.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think that's something we'll have to keep in mind when we think about how we get the implementation
of the growth
portfolio.
What do you think about that? Do you think we ought to just ride it for another 6 months, or do you think we ought to look at putting them on a watch and doing a visit? Do we know what's going on? Do we accept it, not accept it? That's
normally, I would say a watch and a visit probably wouldn't be a bad thing. A, they're close by, and that's easy.
Yeah, they're only in San Francisco, so.
With the FFP transformation that we have going on, if we have bigger moving pieces, this will probably get moved. In terms of the whole growth portfolio and how we end up constructing that, it will probably get wrapped up into that analysis. And so I don't see it as a red flag issue that needs to be taken action on today under, like, the emergency protocols of your IPOs.
And we believe the story they're telling us, and that's the way it's going, so
yeah.
Stay with it.
Yeah. They have the same people there doing the same thing. They have similar stories with other securities that just worked out better, and so this one doesn't work out as well. So, you know, part of it is that as well, I think.
Okay.
Idiosyncratic kind of issues.
Back to a part of the class action suit against Valiant is, you know, probably a good idea not to own it.
Has that been filed? Is it?
I think they're still putting the participants together.
It's going to be a big one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you ever react to something like Bill Ackerman being the primary defender of this and not having lots of confidence in his judgment?
Activist investors in general?
Well, where the record is at best mixed.
No. So, well, we typically don't get involved in the analysis of an individual security. So we're not going to know a whole lot about Valiant. Our question is more of, what was your thought process throughout your ownership of Valiant? When did you decide to buy more, sell more? What made you finally get out of it? How did that whole thesis change? Is that whole story consistent with why we hired you in the first place and the story that you told us then?
Okay.
That's kind of what we're drilling down on. If that changes, that gives us some hesitation.
This has been a high-profile going down company for some time now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another note about Jackson Square is that they have kept you abreast of their departure from Delaware and how that's all gone. And that sounds like that's gone really well. So Delaware acquired a SMidCap manager. And so the SMidCap growth fund that Jackson Square Partners was the sub-advisor to, they're going to lose that mandate, but it looks like they're retaining the rest of it. So at one point they were looking at a total of about $9 billion at risk. It looks like that's going to be just the SMidCap mandate, which I think is like $1 billion. So that's they've done well at mitigating that risk. So that's a business risk that we were concerned about. Looks like that's playing out well. Couple notes on page 11. We have some pretty strong performance here from First Eagle, Intech. on the global equity side, underperformance with JP Morgan Global Opportunities. So JP Morgan had some exposure to the healthcare and financial sectors, as well as telecom stock selection that hurt
them.
That's why they got hurt. Yeah. Down below that, if we take a look at the fixed income side, it's interesting to see how tight these ranges are. So AFL-CIO underperforms the benchmark 2.9 versus 3, and that puts them in the 70th percentile. Mm-hmm. Right below that, Goldman Sachs Core Plus, same benchmark. They outperform 3.1 versus 3.0, and they're in the top third.
Yeah.
That's how tight the grouping is there in the fixed income space.
But just 1/10 of a percent.
Yeah. Mm. So sometimes we have to take those rankings with a grain of salt. And you can see similarly Lord Abbott and PIMCO.
Yeah,
that kind
of. On the good news side, on page 12, PIMCO All Asset Fund outperformed. So they have had some difficult performance over the past year and a half or two. And it looks like their positions in emerging market equity and debt both helped them this quarter, along with longer dated maturity tips.
What about Wellington?
Wellington was long Europe and Japan, both of which underperformed, and they were short Brazil. So, as I mentioned with Brazil, when they started the impeachment process, that market rebounded significantly.
Against their benchmark, that's huge. Their benchmark for the 3 month, 1.7, and then they show a loss of -7?
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah. And the benchmark is CPI
plus
4.
8.7 altogether.
Yeah.
Gone.
Well, the benchmark is a tough benchmark in the sense that CPI plus 4, if there was anything out there that actually generated CPI plus 4 with zero volatility, we'd all jump in it.
I'd take it.
Yeah. So it does convey the sense of what they're telling us. We want to generate a real return of 4% over inflation. So that's what we're seeking to do. But the right way to look at that would be over a full business cycle. Look at it over 7 years, 5 to 7 years, something like that, and see if they do it. We don't quite have that history. We have a 3-year number, and it doesn't look like they're on track to do that so far.
All right.
And I think, Tim, the board has discussed the change in personnel.
They have. They
okay.
We'll place them on watch.
Okay. And finally, Willow's office property at the bottom is now zeroed out, so that brings that account complete. I don't think you'll be seeing that going forward. And there are the final numbers.
The carpets need cleaning by then.
They've been notified.
Pages 16, 17, 18 have the progress of funding on all of the closed-end funds. Nothing particularly noteworthy there. And then pages 19 and 20 have the internal rates of return. Nothing particularly surprising there either. So let me pause and see if there are any final questions on the performance report. If not, let's turn to tab 3. We have the risk dashboard. Actually, the risk dashboard is certainly undergoing some changes as we adopt FFP, but what we're showing in the policy is the FFP 4-year approach. It was actually decided in December, so we'll update that for the current one that was selected last month. So this is just showing on the first page here that the portfolio running a little bit heavy on the portfolio risk, 8.4 versus policy at 7.9. That's given our overweight to equities. Our equity beta, therefore, is slightly higher, which is chart 2. Chart 3, interest rate on page 2, interest rate risk, so showing the duration of the plan at 1.4 versus policy at 1.3, so roughly in line there. Credit spread, credit risk, much lower than policy, 0.7 versus 0.2. And that's because the policy would be driven by private credit, which we haven't started funding yet. So until we start building that out, it's going to continue to be underweight. Okay, so that would conclude my review of the performance, unless there are any questions.
I just want to go back to page 18 and help me. I want to make sure I understand right. Total value paid in on page 18. So,
tab 2? Where are you at?
Page 18, the bottom. On tab, I'm sorry, tab 2.
Tab 2.
Tab 2. So, like Adams Street Partners, the very top one, total paid in 1.35. So, does that mean that we've gotten 135% back, or is it, can you help me understand that number?
Yes.
I think I understand it, but I want to.
Yes.
I need it fed back to me so I know.
So, when we've made the investment in here of total commitment of $210 million.
Yes.
And our current is $120. They've paid us out $75 million.
Yes.
Okay. So, we've, let's see. Total called 69%. So we're not showing the total amount called, but it'd be 69% of the 210.
Yes.
So that's what? Called 140 million.
Okay.
So we paid in 140, they paid us back 75. And we have a remaining market value of 120. So if you take the 75
and the 120,
yep.
Add them together, and that gives you more. And so that's 1.35.
Right on.
That's where. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Ed, well, I'm looking at this. Almost all the latest valuations are as of year end. One is at 3. Exactly. One is at 331. When would you, in the just a normal process, would you expect to see those move up? Is it semi-annually, or do we wait until 12/31/16 for the next value adjustment?
It's roughly quarterly with a lag. They provide us with quarterly valuations. When they get them to us will be over the course of
all right.
The...
All right. So for the June 30th, we would expect to see 331 for
that's right
at least most.
That's right. So what we're doing here,
331 is in right now. So you'll they'll be reflected in the second quarter report. Now we always show the current valuation, be it 3 to 6 months old, plus all capital call positions. So you can see the current activity and the most current valuation.
So that's why the column to the left is called estimated market value. Thanks. What Tim was just saying, the most recent valuation from the manager plus what we know about the money we got back and the money we paid in to get
so,
that.
So is it reasonable to assume that the higher that number is, 1.62 right underneath, the higher that number is, the better the return has been on that fund, and that's a stronger fund for us to, in terms of our investment with it?
Yes and no. If I showed you a fund that had a 2, that would look pretty good. But if it took me 30 years to give you that 2, you'd be pretty disappointed with me.
Got it.
So if I can do it in the course of a week, you'd be pretty. You'd
so
it, wonder
the time period is also important.
Yes. And so the time period dynamic is captured on 19 and 20, the internal rates of returns.
So and I'm just calling, I'm coming off the top of my head from memory. Usually when we go into a fund, we look at, I think it's 7 years, mm-hmm. as the top end of it. Is that kind of the ballpark?
7, 10. Some of them
okay.
will go 12, 13.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Unless it's an open-ended like Adams Street.
Well, Adams Street is closed-ended, but
I thought it was open. I mean, okay, go ahead.
So 19 and 20 give you just that, Jerry. So let's take a look at Torchlight at the top.
Okay.
Torchlight 2, Torchlight 3. You can see some pretty different results here.
Uh-huh.
If we actually, Adams Street Partners that we were just looking at, that 1.35
mm-hmm.
is the first one on page 20.
Mm-hmm.
So here you can see contra costa gross and net. So you're getting a 9.1% net return from them over the life. So since 96 through
96.
Current, so.
Almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Thanks. I never thought about that time frame.
Yeah. And good numbers to know either way. It just depends on what you're trying to solve for.
Harvey?
Ed, would you take a moment to talk about the fee schedules on slide 23 and 24 and what's
Yeah. 23 and 24 behind tab 2 show all of your open-end funds. So these are the fee schedules against the asset, the market values, to show the estimated fee, and this gives us a way of spot checking if there's anything here that pops out at us. There isn't anything, so thank you for bringing me back that. I usually check this box in my performance review. This doesn't, though, capture all of the closed-end funds, which have the agreements with carried interest and such.
And I'm probably stating the obvious, but that's annual.
Yes. Yeah. Estimated annualized fee.
Are the closed-end funds captured somewhere else in the slides?
Not explicitly. So the slide we are showing on IRR is a good one because it shows the net. So it shows contra costa, gross, and net, which would allow you to do the rough comparison there. So going back to page 20, if we took a look at Adams Street, essentially that first fund we're paying 3.1% annual, which is their management fee, carried interest, et cetera, et cetera. It's hard to do the closed-end funds because as they go through their life and their J-curve, when the fees come out and how much you're paying at different points is different. And so the open-end funds lend themselves to that nice schematic. We know we're being charged on assets, and it works well. These are a little different.
You are reporting carried interest as a fee.
That's right.
Do you have an opinion on whether it should be ordinary or capital gain?
No, I don't. Ordinary income or capital gain?
Yeah. I'll go next.
Okay. So that concludes my performance review. Unless there are any questions, or we could transition management.
Do we have an item before that?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Some discussion.